Okay. So what is the philosophy of social science, to start? What I would say is that philosophy of social science is asking really foundational questions, really basic questions about social knowledge. Is there such a thing as a science of society, for example? What is involved in providing a scientific explanation of social phenomena? In other words, how do we explain social outcomes? What is the logical underpinning of an explanation of a social outcome? What is involved in being scientific as opposed to merely observing? For example, are journalists who describe the movements of minorities in China, when they do journalism, are they also being scientific, or is there a big difference between journalism and social science? And I would say there is a difference. And are there scientific methods of inquiry which can guide the social sciences? Several of you come from different areas of the social sciences, political science, international relations, sociology. Last week, anyway, there was someone who did feminism and gender studies, anthropology. There are lots of areas of the social sciences, and the question that we can ask is, is there anything in common in their scientific method of inquiry, or are there really important differences? So that anthropology discussions are very different from political science discussions. If this is going to continue for a while, it's going to be difficult there. Okay. So I felt that it would be a good thing to begin by asking, what is analytic philosophy? What is Western philosophy, or what is analytic philosophy? And I am trained as what is referred to as an analytic philosopher. And here are a couple of pieces of description that I would give to characterize what is philosophy. It is rigorous analysis of the logic and structure of knowledge. This is one of the most basic questions that Western philosophers and analytic philosophers are interested in. What is the nature and structure of knowledge? Not just philosophy of social science, but all of Western philosophy is very much organized around the question, what is the nature of knowledge? The most general questions are posed by analytic philosophy. What is the relationship between the mind and the world? I have consciousness, I have perceptions and sensations, and I refer those sensations to real objects out in the world, but how does that work? What is the relationship between the real world and my consciousness or my representation of the world? That would be a very general philosophical question. What is the nature of rational thought? Thinking is one thing, but thinking rationally is something else. And we would like to know, what is it to think rationally? And, you know, a very early answer would be, to think rationally is to think carefully, rigorously, and to give reasons for the beliefs that we come to. But if that's not a good answer, then are there better answers? And then the third point here, are there objective reasons to help decide ethical or value questions? If I say, this water tastes great, that's a judgment. If I say, it is a virtuous thing to give charity to the poor, or it is a good thing to give charity to the poor, is there a rational basis for making that assertion, or is it really just, I like to do it, you don't like to do it, it's a matter of taste? So philosophers have been interested in the question, are there objective, rational grounds for deciding value issues? I thought it might be useful to give you one example of a philosophical question. And so here's a question that relates to China. I say to you, what is the history of China? And now I ask you to consider, what does the phrase, history of China, what does that refer to? Does it refer to, there now are two possibilities. It could refer to a series of events, the things which happened during the Ming, during the Qing, during the various dynasties in the different parts of China. In other words, it could be the objective events which occurred throughout the long sequence of events in Chinese history. That's one possibility. Here's another possibility. It is the representation of Chinese history by historians. It is the stories that are told. It is the narratives that are told. Well, either of those is an understandable interpretation of the history of China, but I would just ask you to notice how different they are. One has to do with objective series of events. The other has to do with the representation of events in the form of narrative or historical knowledge. But we can also ask, here's another completely different kind of question, what is the nature of the relationship between thinking, brain activity, and behavior? When you think, you're aware, you have an internal thought process, right? You think of a particular thing, and it is a conscious experience that you have. You also, if you are a biologist, you also think that your thinking is embodied in your brain in some way. The brain is a computer or something like that. Well, that would be the beginning of an analysis of the relationship between thought and brain. But we also want to know, what's the relationship between thought and behavior? I think it would be cooler in the room if I closed the door and then I go and close the door. That would be an example of a relationship between thought and behavior. Well, this is a philosophical question, and a philosopher can then engage himself in pulling that question apart and studying it. The main fields of analytic philosophy, I put philosophy of science at the top of the list, the philosophy of physics, the philosophy of biology, the philosophy of economics. If you were to ask me, what are the most prestigious fields of philosophy in the United States today, I would say the philosophy of science, including philosophy of biology, philosophy of physics, possibly the philosophy of economics, those are the most prestigious fields. And then the second most prestigious field is ethics, the field of ethics. But other fields that philosophers talk about, philosophy of language, philosophy of mathematics and logic, philosophy of mind, and then ethics, the philosophy of values. Here we can ask the question, what are the rational principles which make the basis of the judgments which we make about society, the judgments of conduct, the judgments of justice, the judgments of good institutions, bad institutions. There is, of course, in Chinese philosophy, is it the philosopher Mencius, who has a theory of just political institutions. Well, that would be a good example of a philosophical study of the principles that define a good society or a bad society. This is also a part of social and political philosophy. Questions like, what is freedom? What is freedom? And philosophers have sometimes said there are two different kinds of freedom. There is positive freedom and negative freedom. Positive freedom being the freedom to do things, and negative freedom being freedom from constraint. So if I am locked up in handcuffs, I am unfree in a negative sense. If I am uneducated and therefore unable to write a book, I am unfree in a positive sense, meaning I do not have the freedom to write the book. No one prevents me, but I don't have the intellectual development that would allow me to write a book, and therefore I do not possess positive freedom. That would be an example of a social and political question. I mentioned John Rawls at the bottom of this page, who wrote a book called A Theory of Justice. And John Rawls is probably the most well-known social and political philosopher in the United States. This book had a huge influence, the book called A Theory of Justice. If you were trying to place the book on a political spectrum, you know, if you thought of socialist justice on the left, and you thought of capitalist justice on the right, then John Rawls's theory would be more like the justice of social democracy. It would be sort of in the middle. It would be a justice that endorses the justice of private property, but which also endorses the idea that it is a role of the state to provide positive benefits for the citizens of a country. So it's kind of a it's a defense of liberalism in a fairly progressive sense, I would say. So now back to the philosophy of social science. I've sort of argued to you so far that philosophy should consider and it should contribute to the methodology of the social sciences. The next question that you would want to ask is, how should it do that? Is there a philosophical method for approaching problems like, what is the nature of social science? And what I advocate, and this is somewhat distinctive of the writings that you are reading of mine, what I advocate is that philosophers should address these problems by working hand in hand with working social scientists. That as we ask the question, is there a good science of society, the philosopher at the very same time should be learning what good sociology theory is, and what good political science theory is, and what some of the hard questions are which political scientists are having to grapple with. One such example, just to give you a small example, in political science, in game theory, there is the there's the whole mathematical theory of game theory, two-person game theory, and the idea of an equilibrium. The equilibrium set of strategies which are such that neither party would be rationally induced to change his position if he knew what the other party was doing. That is referred to as an equilibrium. Well, a philosophical question is, what is the nature of an equilibrium, and how do we manage the problem that economics and the theory of games doesn't tell us how a group of people come to an equilibrium? That would be a concrete problem which political scientists have to consider, and a philosopher could make a contribution to that. So I'm saying that the philosophy of social science should not be an a priori formulation. It should not be, hi, welcome. No, I should not be, I keep welcoming the guys who are fixing the thing there. should not be a priori, should not be purely philosophical. Instead, it should be carefully and fully engaged with good examples of social inquiry. And I must say, part of my excitement in being at PKU, at MEDA, is part of my excitement is the fact that there is such good social science research which is happening in the Department of Sociology, in the study of minorities. This is a very energetic time of social science research, and I would like to learn more about the research which is going on in China. I would like to be involved in that in some way. So my advice is this third bullet here, that we should formulate methodological and philosophical maxims. In other words, formulate philosophical theories on the basis of study of good practice. Now, there's something kind of intriguing about this, because it has to do with the unity of theory and practice. What I'm basically saying is that you can't arrive at a good philosophy of social science without knowing pretty well the practice of good working social scientists. In other words, we can't just be purely theoretical. We must be engaged in real hands-on engagement with working social scientists. Now, within the philosophy of social science, there are a bunch of different types of questions we could ask. We could ask about inquiry. What is inquiry? It's the way in which we pursue knowledge. So we could ask the question, how should social science inquiry be conducted? Which is really to say, are there methods which are particularly useful or particularly likely to lead to good results in the various disciplines, sociology, anthropology, and so forth? A second major topic is the topic of ontology, which is, I imagine it's a Latin word, but what it means is ontology has to do with what kinds of things are there in the world. So ontology has to do with the question, what kinds of things are there in the world? And I put it to you that we need to have a good understanding of a social ontology. We need to be able to answer to ourselves the question, what kind of social things are there, which we can then investigate. And I find this a very difficult question. If I were to say to you, the Chinese state wishes for rapid economic growth, the Chinese state wants to see rapid economic growth, well, do you notice that I'm referring to an entity, the Chinese state, right? And yet, we can ask ourselves, what are we referring to? Are we referring to the top of the Chinese state, the president or prime minister, the general executive officer? Are we referring to the bureaus, the many, many offices and general, you know, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Development, the Ministry of Minorities, whatever the ministries are? Are we referring to the whole thing, all state institutions? That's one question. And then a second question is, if we throw our conceptual net very broadly, then how can it be that that very broad thing, which extends out into all the provinces and into provincial offices and into village offices, if that's what we're referring to as the state, how can it be meaningful to say the state desires something? Individuals desire things, maybe small groups of coordinated persons, you know, like the inner leadership circle, perhaps they desire things, but large extended social entities don't desire things. In other words, we can learn a lot by probing into what do we mean by referring to abstract extended social entities. That's the ontology question. A third question, theory and hypothesis. What is the role of theory in social sciences? What is the role of hypotheses? And there are different views on this matter. In physics, it is taken to be just an obvious truth that the best explanations of physical phenomena require theories of things like electrical charge and quantum mechanics and so forth. Those are theories or hypotheses about unobservable processes and entities. Question, do we need to have theories and hypotheses in the social sciences? I'm not going to answer the question, but I simply put it out there that our answer needs to be a reflective and deliberative answer. And then the final two points, explanation, what are the varieties of social explanation? What counts as a good social explanation? What are we looking for when we say, I would like to explain the fact that, I don't know, the sex ratios in a certain county are 120 men to 100 women. That would be a social outcome. And then if I were to say, I'd like to have an explanation of that outcome, what is it that I'm looking for? What would count as a good explanation of that social outcome? Finally, justification. Justification has to do with the rational credibility of the beliefs which we put forward. If I say to you, Beijing is a place of very friendly people, and you were to say to me, what is your rational justification for believing that? And I were to say to you, I took a cab ride yesterday, and the driver was very pleasant to me, and I saw a lot of smiling people on the street. You would very naturally say back to me, that's not a good justification for your belief. You haven't consulted, you haven't drawn enough evidence, you haven't done surveys, you've just got an impression that is not a justified belief. Well, in general, we can ask that question about social science hypotheses. If we have a theory about the minorities in China, or if we have a theory about male-female relations in Western China, whatever theories we put forward, we can ask the question, what is the justification that we have for the theories that we put forward? And really, what I'm kind of asserting to you is that this list of five topic areas maybe comes pretty close to establishing the geography. It's so cool, just gesturing here in the dark, where you can barely see me. What I would say is that these five questions establish the geography of the topic areas of the philosophy of social science. Now, it may turn out, I mean, there are other questions that philosophers have asked. One that occurs to me as I stand here is the question, what is the role of values in social science inquiry? That's a good question, and I didn't mention it here. There are other questions that we could ask, but this is a pretty good start. Okay, we're making a pause here. And we are all of 13 minutes into our lecture. That's good. We're making good progress. My thought is to pile right on, though. Just keep on going. So let's keep on going. Explanation. What is social science explanation? And I would like to put it forward that we can offer a very simple account of what a good explanation is. An explanation, I would say, is a demonstration of why the event or the pattern or regularity, why the event was necessary or probable in the circumstances. So we explain an event when we can provide grounds for showing that that event was necessary or probable in the circumstances. And the details of the explanation identify the prior factors which jointly establish the necessity or the probability of the event. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that an explanation, if we have a weird and an anomalous and unexpected result, if, for example, this class was chosen by people applying for the class, and if it had happened that the only people in the class were female, that would be an unexpected result, because I'm sure that the PKU summer school is pretty much balanced between female and male students. So to have a class which is entirely female is an anomaly. To give an explanation is to identify the factors which brought about the outcome of having a female-only class. And you might have different explanations. One explanation is philosophy is overwhelmingly more interesting to women than to men. That would be a possible explanation. So individuals made separate choices. Men chose sport. Women chose philosophy, and it just reflects their underlying preference structure. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that there is a discriminating person in the summer school who made the choice. The men who apply will be put somewhere else, and the women who apply will be allowed in. That would be a different explanation. Well, the point I'm getting at is to provide an explanation is to identify the circumstances which brought about the outcome. Now, you'll notice that I hedge here a little bit. I say the circumstances which made it necessary or probable. And it is, in my mind, an important thing to recognize that social phenomena are really more frequently than not probabilistic phenomena rather than deterministic phenomena. The example would be if a person who had the SARS virus came into this room today. I don't want to make anybody freaked out or anything, but if a person with the SARS virus came into the room, the probability of any one of us contracting SARS might be 1 in 10. Okay, so a person is in, she sneezes a couple times loudly, and she leaves. And then we might say the probability based on epidemiology is that there is a 1 in 10 likelihood that someone will contract the SARS virus from that exposure. Well, the point is it's not inevitable that someone will. It's just a probability of 1 in 10. But if then you actually contract the SARS virus, our explanation will be the exposure. You were exposed to the virus on July 5th, and that elevated your probability, and that's why the outcome occurred. So both probabilistic and necessary condition explanations are relevant. Now, the second bullet here is actually an important point. I've been sort of emphasizing explanation shows why an event was necessary in the circumstances, why it had to happen in those circumstances. But sometimes it's true when we are asking for an explanation, we're asking how is it possible that this event could occur as opposed to why was it necessary. An example of a how possible outcome would be I probably can't give this example very well, but if I were to take a deck of cards, shuffle them 100 times, and then turn them over and they come out in order. The one of clubs, no, ace of clubs, king of clubs, queen of clubs, jack of clubs, etc., all the way through 52 cards. That seems impossible. How could that happen? Well, to give an explanation would be to allow us to have some mechanism by which that outcome could occur. So that would be a how possible explanation. Third bullet, also an important one. In the social sciences, we explain both singular events. Why did this particular class turn out to be equally men and women? That's a single outcome. But a generic outcome, why are classes at Peking University Summer School evenly mixed between men and women? That would be a general phenomenon. And social scientists are interested in explaining both singular outcomes and also generic outcomes. And there is some controversy here. So I'm just flagging right now that this is a topic of some interest. What is an explanation? What is the logical structure of an explanation? Well, I would put it to you, and Western philosophers would put it, that an explanation is an argument. It is a logical argument in which there are a set of premises and a conclusion, and the premises are such that if the premises are true, then the conclusion also must be true. That would be to refer to an argument as a deductively valid argument. In order to get probability in here, we have to have also the idea of probabilistic inference. If the premises are true, then it is likely that the conclusion is true. But what I'm putting forward is an explanation is a simple thing. An explanation is an argument, either deductively valid or probabilistic argument, from a set of premises to a conclusion. And the hard part is coming up with the premises. Coming up with the statements of fact which jointly entail the outcome. What is referred to as the covering law explanation, or theory of explanation, was a very general theory of explanation put forward by an American philosopher named Carl Hempel, Hempel, H-E-M-P-E-L. What he asserted was that all scientific explanation is a deductive argument containing at least one general law and then several statements of fact. So if in Beijing the temperature drops to minus 20 degrees centigrade, and if you have a radiator filled with water, a water bottle filled with water, and in the morning you go out and you find that your water bottle has exploded, how do you explain that event? Well, there would be a general principle that says water expands when frozen. There would be a particular statement, the temperature dropped to negative 20 degrees C. The inference then is the capacity of the bottle was exceeded and the bottle exploded. That would be a covering law explanation. I would also call it a causal explanation. We'll talk about that in a minute. But an important point here is that the covering law model presumes that what is of scientific interest is general laws. And that's the point that I dispute in the social sciences. And so I refer also to a mechanism explanation. A mechanism explanation is an explanation which describes a series of mechanisms leading from an initial condition to the outcome. Now, it may be that we can show that mechanism explanations and covering law explanations can be translated back and forth, but I would say pragmatically, many scientific explanations, especially in the social sciences, are what I call a mechanism explanation, where we're looking to a sequence of conditions or circumstances, one of which led to the next, which led finally to the outcome. My central thesis for today is that social science explanation is causal explanation. A good explanation of a social phenomenon or an outcome or a pattern or regularity, a good explanation is a causal explanation. That is, it's an explanation which identifies the condition or conditions which are such that when those conditions obtain, the outcome obtains. And we'll look at some examples tomorrow, actually. I also assert that what I refer to as causal realism is the best interpretation of causal explanation. And what causal realism is a theory that says there are real causes in the world. objects and structures and entities and conditions have real causal powers, and it is in light of those causal powers that causal processes ensue. If I were to take a magnet and a set of iron filings, I wonder if you did this experiment when you were in school. So you put the iron filings on the piece of paper, and you put the magnet underneath, shake the paper a little bit, and you get the iron filings line up with the magnetic field. Is that a familiar experiment to you? Well, we could ask, why do the iron filings line up? What I would say is that the magnet has the causal power of exerting a magnetic field, and the iron filings are influenced by that magnetic field. They then align with the magnetic field, and we get the pattern, the resulting pattern. Well, that would be a causal realist interpretation. It would say that there are real causal properties associated with the magnet. A couple of technicalities here. This is, I'm disagreeing with some approaches to the social sciences. I'm saying causal explanation is the central kind of explanation. Some social scientists, especially in American sociology in the 1950s and 1960s, were functionalist theories. They explained social circumstances by saying this circumstance exists in order to bring about the good functioning of the system as a whole. Now, in biology, we do that all the time. Here's a biological question. Why is the lung filled with air pockets and blood vessels? Answer, in order to absorb oxygen to circulate to the organism to allow the organism to survive. That is a functionalist explanation. It explains the structure of the lung in terms of the function which the lung plays within the functioning organism. And it's actually a good scientific explanation. Some social scientists have said, well, if it's good for biology, it's good for social science too. And therefore, if we ask why do states take in taxes, why do states take in taxes from the people in order to allow the state to fund social services? That might be the functional explanation. And the answer that what I would say is, no, that's not a good social science explanation. That's not a good social science explanation. That's a truck. We would just talk a little louder, and that would be perfectly fine. It's not a good explanation because in the social sciences, we do not have what we do have in biology, which is the principle of natural selection. Notice what's funny about a functionalist explanation. It explains an outcome. It explains an outcome by its consequences. But how can you ever explain an outcome by its consequences? How can something that happens in the future influence the existence and nature of a thing at a certain time? Do you see the puzzle here? How can something about the future explain the present or the past? That's a tough question. Well, in biology, we have a good explanation, and that is natural selection. That the organism has developed in such a way that when the lungs are made out of plastic, the organism develops a plastic lung. Well, it doesn't support oxygenation, and the organism dies. So we have a filtering of the systems, the biological systems, which do not fulfill the function. And what we result in is a system where the characteristics of the system do, in fact, fulfill the function. Well, that's a perfectly good explanation, and it doesn't refer to future consequences. It refers to causal processes at the time. In the social sciences, I say to you, this can challenge you, we don't have that alternative, that natural selection alternative, because we don't have anything like natural selection and mutation among social institutions, or if we do, it's not nearly as powerful a mechanism. So in other words, we'd have to have a different mechanism. Here's another kind of mechanism, though. You will work hard in this course, because I've set standards of writing, reading, and grading So the writing, reading, and grading standards from this course lead to the good result of you working hard. You could say that's a functional explanation too. The difference, though, is that I designed that institution. I designed the writing, reading, and grading arrangements in the course in such a way as to bring about the good result. In other words, when a system is designed, it's not difficult to say how a function came to be. The designer, the engineer, the social architect created the system in order to bring about certain consequences. And so that's easy enough. Though, wonderful line of thought to dive into, because we also know that often design goes wrong. So we design, it might be, for example, in fact, this happens in U.S. universities all the time, I give you writing assignments to make you work hard, but you go out to the internet and find sources of papers and bring them in and cheat, and therefore you don't work hard. Well, that would be an unintended consequence. So anyway, I argue functional explanations are generally suspect in the social sciences because we need to be able to provide a causal feedback system which would account for the social characteristic, and usually we don't have such a characteristic. We don't have natural selection, in other words. Another topic which I take issue with, it's the idea, I take big issue with this question, because this question actually derives from an analogy between the natural sciences and the social sciences. So people answer the question, what is social science? And they say, well, it must be very much like natural science. What does natural science do? Natural science discovers laws of nature. Therefore, erroneous conclusion, what does social science do? It should discover laws of society, or it should discover regularities. And I have, and you will be reading, a sustained argument to the effect that the social sciences generally do not discover strong regularities. There are regularities in the social sciences, but they're weak, they're not predictive, and they result from human agency in ways which makes them inherently unreliable. So I take the view that social regularities exist, but that they are weak and they are exception-laden. They're not analogous to laws of nature. In language that you'll see in one of my essays called On the Scope and Limit of Generalizations, I say that they are phenomenal rather than governing. A governing regularity would be one which pushes a system, and a phenomenal regularity would be one which simply results. So it turned out that most people taking classes at Peking University were from within 500 miles of Peking. If that turned out to be true, that would be a phenomenal regularity. It would be just a kind of brute generalization about people. It would have an explanation, but it wouldn't allow us to make strong predictions about other social circumstances. So I assert, once again, the goal of social inquiry, this is an important point, the goal of social inquiry should be to arrive at hypotheses about underlying social mechanisms that produce both outcomes and also regularities. That the focus of study then should be to discover the underlying social mechanisms. And this is a really important point. If you were jotting any note down to be discussed later, it would be on the subject of social mechanisms. So I would also say all of tomorrow's lecture is on this subject, so we'll have a chance to talk about it tomorrow. Predictions, I also make the argument that social predictions are generally unreliable. That's almost self, there's a little paradox in what I just said, because what I just said is actually a prediction. It's saying if you make predictions, they're not going to work out. And if predictions generally don't work out, then maybe that prediction also won't work out. But what I assert is that the social sciences give rise to theoretical reasons for believing certain kinds of predictions. But what we have to recognize is that predictions always make what we might call simplifying assumptions. Other things being equal, ceteris paribus is a term that philosophers use, ceteris paribus, other things being equal. And yet, things are generally not simple, so that the conditions of a prediction are often not satisfied, and therefore the prediction goes awry. Okay, theories and hypotheses, what's the role of a theory? The general point that I'm making here is that I do believe that the social sciences need to make use of theories. And as we think about, especially the people who've studied sociology, as we think about what is called sociological theory, we think of the theories of Durkheim, of Weber, Max Weber, of Karl Marx. We think of the theories of rational choice theory, collective action theory. We think of the theory of ethnic identities. We think of theories of gender and gender identities, of homosexuality. All of these are theories and hypotheses. And my general view is that these are, number one, needed in the social sciences. Number two, they are rationally defensible. We can do empirical investigation to inquire into our theories of patriarchy, for example, or our theories of gender relations, or our theories of homosexuality. So each theory itself can be, in a sense, separately empirically investigated. And then as we construct explanations, it is always open to us to refer to those theories as being theories of underlying causal mechanisms. In other words, I want to make the connection between bodies of theory and hypothesis and the search for causal mechanisms. There's a kind of contrast that you could draw. In physics, there is the goal to have one general theory that explains everything. The idea of reductionism, bringing chemistry and physics into a single theory and then taking the premises of that theory and consolidating further, coming down finally to just one theory of everything, gravity, electromagnetic relationships, strong force, weak force, one central theory. In physics, that is a model and an ideal and a goal. I say, in the social sciences, it is a ridiculous goal. It is not a feasible, not an attainable goal. It's not even a desirable goal. Rather, theory functions in a different way. It functions, there's a well-known sociologist in America called Robert Merton, who wrote about theories of the middle range. Theories should function as, in my opinion, theories should function as accounts and hypotheses of the workings of specific kinds of social mechanisms. So that a theory, a body of theory, should actually be understood as a toolbox. So you have a hammer, you have a nail, you have a screwdriver, you have a wrench. In other words, you have tools which can be suited to many different applications. That's how I would like to think of sociological theory and social science theory. That the theories that we learn as graduate students, we shouldn't think, well, now I know Durkheim's theory of collective identities, everything looks like a collective identity problem to me. That's a bad approach to social science research. Instead, we should be aware of, dozens of theories, and then their concrete circumstances where those theories can be applied. And then, when we go to study minorities in the northeast of China, we've got collective action theory, rational choice theory, gender theory, race theory. We've got a whole bunch of different theories which we can use to explain and analyze the basic phenomena that we're exposed to. And what I would say is that each of these theories is a theory about some important social process. What I'm denying is the idea that there is one most basic, most fundamental social process which drives everything else. So that we should have a batch of theories rather than one unified theory. So we should be eclectic. We should have multiple theories. If you think of ethnic violence, for example, if you think of violence in Southeast Asia, I'm thinking of Sri Lanka, for example, and the violence between Sinhalese and Buddhist people, and the village against village, the Tamil Tigers. This is all phenomena that you've heard of, I'm sure. The question is, why is there Hindu-Muslim violence in India? Why does Hindu-Muslim violence arise in India at various times, when with the very same population 20 years later, it's not a violent time. So why is there violence sometimes and no violence other times? That's an important comparative sociological question. And I would say, in order to answer that question, here are three things we need to know, and it's only three. Maybe there are 10 things we need to know. We'd like to know, what is the role of political entrepreneurs within the various parties? The radical, the Hindu Nationalist Party, for example. What role do the political entrepreneurs play in whipping up Hindu identities? What about identity politics? Why do people come to regard themselves as first and foremost Hindu and only secondarily a pharmacist? Why is it that the Hindu identity is more important than the professional identity? Well, we need to have a theory of that. What role do material conflicts of interest play? Is it that Muslims are poor and Hindus are well off, and so the conflict is really a material conflict? Well, again, none of these theories predicts what the answer will be, but in order to explain and understand the phenomena, we need to be aware of all of these different kinds of social phenomena. So multiple theories correspond to distinct mechanisms and processes. We should use the model of a toolbox rather than a unified theory of everything. Ontology, making good progress here, and I make a personal promise to you, we will not go past 55 minutes in lecture, so we've got another 15 minutes about to go. Ontology, that's the question, what exists in the social world? And we can ask, do states, do markets, do global trading systems exist? I'd like for you to think about that question. China is a part of a world trading system. Does the world trading system as such exist? Or could we say something more modestly, what exists are a bunch of companies which have offices and ships and telegraph machines and internet accounts and so forth, government bureaus. In other words, should we be thinking of the world trading system as a networked set of lesser objects rather than being an object of its own with its own characteristics? That's a different way of thinking about the higher level social entity. Or, you know, putting it a little more generally, how are higher level things composed out of lower level things? Here's a concept of a thing, a table. A table is a thing. You would agree that a table is a thing. A table consists of four legs and a top. So we could ask the question, does the table exist? Or really, is the table just a construct, and what really exists are the legs and the top? But of course, we can push that down because the legs themselves consist of wood. Wood consists of molecules of carbon, whatever. Or in other words, there's no stable place where we can say, this is the right level of ontology. And therefore, we've got a philosophical challenge. How should we decide what is the right level of ontology? Should we go higher, world trading system, or should we go a little bit lower, networks of corporations, governmental organizations, NGOs, nations, or should we push it even further down? And what would be the reasons that favor one level of ontology versus another? Now this is kind of personal, not personal exactly, but it's my considered judgment on these matters, and not all philosophers would agree with this, but what I would like to put forward to you is a very simple social ontology. It is to say that individuals in social relations and individuals in institutions, these are the things that exist from a social point of view. So that you belong to university, you belong to a place where you live, you belong possibly to a religious organization, a church or a temple or whatever. These are the institutions which define your social setting. And what I want to put forward is that the individuals in these concrete social relations and concrete local institutions, that's what really exists. And we can then extend outward analysis of the networks and the connections which these social, kind of local social arrangements lead out into. We'll talk quite a bit more about institutions and organizations a bit later, but the central point here is that institutions are locally embodied systems of rules, opportunities, and prohibitions. And when the institution creates a set of rules, of course, the institution doesn't do it. The people of the institution do it. When the Peking University Summer School says, in order to register for this class, you must have good English, well, that's a rule. You can try to evade the rule. You can try to conform to the rule. You can try to change the rule. But the rule is out there, and it has a certain amount of force. There was originally supposed to be an interviewer. I didn't advocate for this, but there was the idea of a filter that would say, we have the rule and we have a mechanism of enforcement. Or the point is then, once the institution exists, it has some autonomy, some independence from you. You have to conform or adapt your behavior to the institution. Well, that's what I'm saying is kind of the elementary unit of social analysis. And of course, it's true that institutions then can be stacked up. They get nested or they get put into larger and larger combinations. But at every point, this is an international relations point writ large, at every point, we then have to ask, what is the form of connection between one level of the institution and other levels of the institution? I'm reading right now a very interesting piece of Chinese history about tax collection in the late Qing period into the early Republican period in North China. So it's in a specific county. But what the author shows is that the county administration did not extend to the village, but that there were village institutions of tax collection which worked pretty well, which served the interests of villagers, but also served the interests of the state. Well, that would be an example of local institutions. And then what's interesting about the history that the man writes is that he shows what the relationship is between the village level and the county level. How the power of the county officer, county magistrate, was related to the power of the village head, and how those relationships obtained, with the result that tax collections under normal circumstances were very good. 98% of taxes assessed were actually paid. In other institutional arrangements, it might be 60%, and it might take a lot of effort on the part of the state. Voila. This is the last slide on this lecture. Once in a while, I've thrown in a picture. I believe this is from an important piece of social science by G. William Skinner, and you may recognize it as a little bit of Chinese geography. So that's kind of interesting, kind of relevant for us. But it's also an application of a theory. It is the theory is called central place theory. It's a theory of economic geography. And what the theory asserts is that places, higher level and lower level places, villages, hamlets, lesser market towns, higher market towns, you see the hierarchy that I'm talking about, that the hierarchy of central places gets distributed across the countryside in a way which corresponds roughly to hexagons, with a higher level place in the center, and then six places around it, and each place then surrounded by more hexagons. And this is predicted by economic geography, having to do basically with transport cost and population density. So this is actually, even though it's just the conclusion of this particular lecture, it's also an interesting example of some of the content of the lecture, because it is both concrete social reality in China and, 1700, but also the application of an important social science theory to the explanation of a pattern. I didn't provide the next couple of slides, which Bill Skinner offers, but what he does is he takes this geography and turns it into the hexagonal architecture or geometry, which is predicted by central place theory. I do actually have those slides. If you're interested, I can show them to you. So that is 46 minutes and 1 second of lecture one.